It's with the American Optical, very nice people. They were located back east. Somebody asked a question, I don't know which one of you asked me about, but I thought about the east versus the west.
Yeah.
The thing that I was aware of at PerkinElmer and became enormously aware of at American Optical was that they were arch-conservative. They wouldn't do anything. It was a miracle that they had convinced themselves that they should buy this SEM company, because it was such a complicated super electronic, super vacuum system product that was so far afield from making eyeglasses and all this stuff. I became aware how just how conservative they were, and I would make proposals for things that we should do, and they would always turn them down, because especially if it involved investing any money. So that's the main difference that I found between East and West, is the Eastern business conservatism during those days was so terrible. Well, terrible is the wrong word. Was so prevalent. And here was Silicon Valley just starting up with all these ideas and things going on and wonderful things. I'm meeting people and doing all kinds of stuff. It was such a revelation to me because that's the way PerkinElmer was in the early days, and it was no longer that way. And they suddenly became, I suddenly became aware of the fact that things were really happening in California. And so that was the place to make an investment. So that's what I did. Nanometrics is a good example of that. This company could never have started back east.
Why is that?
When I first started Nanometrics and first designed the first nanospecs, I invited American Optical to sell the product for me. And they sent their sales manager from Buffalo, New York in, and he looked at it, and he, you know, we were friends and so forth, and he said, "Vince, what did you design that for? There's no market for that." I said, "What do you mean there's no market?" I said, "It's brand new, therefore you have to develop a market." Okay, yeah. "Well, we're busy selling optical microscopes. We can't be bothered with that." So that's just what happened. That was the attitude. That's been the attitude in most of the electronics thing. Of course, Bell Labs invented the transistor but didn't do a hell of a lot with it. And IBM, of course, had a powerhouse organization and they were able to do a lot of things. But most of the stuff was done out here with Intel and National Semiconductor and on and on and on and on. And it has moved. It's gone through California, is now over there in Asia. And it may not last very long because of this SARS epidemic, possibly, that it's not going to really, it's taken root, but whether it will grow. There's so much going on, there's so many problems that I wonder what's going to happen to the electronics industry in China and Taiwan and Japan. But the United States seems to be not as active in new ideas, doing new stuff.
In 75, that time period when you're sitting down with the clean slate to design a new product, did you have in mind the idea to go after this semiconductor metrology market?
No, not at all.
How did that emerge as a focus, as a concentration?
Do you want to hear that story?
I do.
I designed the product, and the thing that occurred to me was that there would be a market for the measurement of biological samples that were being tagged with fluorescence in order to identify cancer or so forth and so on. So I thought that my spectrophotometer could be useful in measuring the emission from samples, because when you look through an optical microscope, you see something, but you don't know what it is. By putting a spectrophotometer on top, you can then measure something about that object that would tell you what its composition was or what it was and so forth. So that was my idea. So I designed it, and I showed it to some people down in Southern California, and one of the at the University of California, Irvine, guy down there bought one and started using it, and I started working closely with him, and then Stanford University was interested in it. And then there was a meeting of the cell biology group. It's a big, big meeting, maybe 5 or 10,000 people in Boston. So I signed up to show my new product at the cell biology meeting. And I had hired a guy from New Jersey to be my salesman, to be a rep. And he met me in Boston, and I set the product up, and we were there in the booth, and these people kept walking by the booth, but nobody ever came in. I tried to grab people and bring them in, but there was nobody interested in fluorescence. Nobody was interested in doing this that I could find. So I was getting pretty discouraged, and we were standing in the booth, and he said to me, I was talking to a guy down at Bell Labs about your product, and he told me that he thought it was interesting. And I said, really? I said, I didn't know that Bell Labs was doing a lot of biological stuff. He said, no, he's doing something called integrated circuits. And he thought that it could be used to measure very small areas and measure the film thickness on integrated circuits. And so I said, oh, yeah, we could do that. Oh. So I said, wait a minute. And I got out the boxes and I put the equipment back in the boxes. We went down to his car and we left the show after the second day and drove down to New Jersey to Bell Labs. And I went in there and I set the thing up, and he got the guy. He called him ahead of time. And he came in and he looked at it. He brought in a semiconductor wafer, and I pushed the button and I made some measurements for him right on the spot. That's the history. So the company was never intended to do this, but it ended up doing it purely by happenstance.
Had you become acquainted with the sort of cell biology field through the electron microscopy?
To a certain extent.
Uh-huh.
Yes, to a certain extent.
Right.
I thought that there would be a interest.
Mm.
Today, there's a huge interest in this. This is just the place where it all is to measure the fluorescence of materials, put in tags. This guy that just identified SARS on the University of California, San Francisco, bright young guy, has made this slide that he put lots and lots of little viruses on, and he was able to put on a slurry with this SARS virus in it, and then with a little fluorescent spot lit up, he then could identify the SARS. He's like the rock star of biology now. His name is Joe DeCicci, and he is a brilliant young guy. So this stuff is going on all over the place now.
Hmm. And so
I was only 25 years ahead of my
time. Yeah, I was just gonna say.
It's still a good idea.
With that conversation at Bell Labs, then how did you change tack? Did you really then start to focus and talk to other people involved with semiconductors and integrated
circuits? No, he said that if I were to modify it so it would actually print out the answers, you would buy one.
That's all.
So I came back out to my place, and sure enough, we modified it and made it work. And then before I got that one going, Intel wanted one, and then National Semiconductor wanted one. And before I knew what was going on there, I had orders for 15 or 20 of these things.
How had they heard about it?
We went around and talked to them.
Okay.
Because we knew that there was an application. We asked them, are you guys interested in measuring films? And, oh, of course we are. Do you have a way of doing it? They were doing it, the gross with a test thing, but they couldn't go down inside an actual integrated circuit thing and then find a little spot and measure that spot in actual production. That was the big thing.
And how did you acquire the technology to combine sort of the hardware and the software with your instruments that you started to produce in Nanometrics? Was that an interest of yours, or?
Well, when I designed that product, PC did not exist.
Mm-hmm.
You could not buy a anything like that. Next door to me in my little place where I was building stuff, there was a guy who was building some of the first PCs. So I happened to talk to him and went over and he showed me. So that's it, that box there. He built that box and put the boards in it, and I hired a guy and we did the software programming so that we could make these. That's what he said, he wanted to have this thing print out, so I had to do software to make that happen.
Mm.
So this guy next door built those early computer boxes, and later on, of course, you could get these from all over the place.
Right.
2 or 3 years later, but during that early period of time, you couldn't do it. Intel was just getting going, in effect.
Mm-hmm. Over time, how closely connected was this new emerging semiconductor metrology business? How coupled was that to the fates of the U.S. semiconductor industry? Did your business match their cycles?
We went up like mad and became a very sizable company and very profitable, and we've sold, as I mentioned, something like 5,000 of our film thickness measuring systems plus other stuff that we've added during this whole period of time. And as I mentioned, the Silicon Valley has gotten quieter. There aren't any very many new companies coming in making integrated circuits. They're all over in Taiwan or Japan or Korea and so forth, and now some in China. So it's kind of moved over, and there isn't that much action. In fact, as you drove in here, you may have noticed there are a lot of empty buildings.
Mm-hmm.
There are buildings and those cars, no cars in the parking lot. That's just in the last couple of years, 2 years, this has happened. So they've sort of gone away. I don't know where they've gone to, but they're not around. So it's an interesting point that's happening to industry in general and to our industry in particular, and that is that we seem to be becoming a service-oriented country, buying stuff from China and other places, and then having people sell it in this country, and shirts and socks and everything, integrated circuits. So we have a nice business selling a lot of our stuff in Japan and Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, China. So that's the largest part of our business these days is in Asia.
So when those markets sort of in Japan and Korea got to a certain size, is that when you would establish, a foreign subsidiary?
Well, we would start with having a service company with service engineers in that country on site.
Right.
So that we could quickly service our products when we delivered them. Then as time passed, it became apparent that there were either other products or some of our products should be transferred to manufacture there, because it maybe that harks back to my experience with Perkin-Elmer, that we would manufacture there, and then the Korean company would be very happy to have a local manufacturer, and this would help our business, of course.
Mm.
So that's what we did in Japan. We did that in Korea. We haven't done it in Taiwan, although we have a very sizable service and sales organization there.
Mm-hmm. And what about Europe? Did that drop off the... Do you have a subsidiary in Europe?
The European semiconductor market has been modest. Some of the larger companies like Siemens and Philips have participated in it. There hasn't been an awful lot of other companies that have grown there. So it's kind of, Europe is kind of weak, although they're kind of nationalistic and they try to buy from Siemens and Philips, even though those products are maybe not as good, but they buy them because they're made within the European market.
How have you enjoyed working for yourself over your career at Nanometrics? Has it been better than working for others? Or?
Well, the answer is resoundingly yes. I really have enjoyed having the ability to make decisions and have things happen. One of the things that happened at Perkin-Elmer is I started off with this clean plate and with the ability to make decisions because nobody was paying any attention. So I went through 4 or 5 years of just making all the decisions and making things happen and going down and telling manufacturing what they should do next and ordering stuff and building it up and working a little bit with salespeople. And nobody bothered. But as soon as it got to be a business that started to look like it was going to make money, suddenly everybody was interested. Mm-hmm. And then I no longer had the kind of free hand to make decisions. And that got to be a little old after a while. Because
mm-hmm.
I was used to the idea of saying, oh, we're going to do this, and that's what we're going to do. And then having somebody not agree, and then the thing wouldn't happen. And so part of the problem at Perkin-Elmer that I encountered was the inability to make things happen because the company was getting too large, too well organized to allow freedom. And it's a thing that I've tried to maintain here with the younger people is that they have the freedom to do stuff on their own,
mm-hmm.
not have people second guess them. If they have a good idea, you make the idea happen, which is has been my experience.
Hmm.
And so I think we've done a lot of that, and it's been very successful for us.
Did things change at all when you took the company public in this respect of having a free hand in the transition from a private to a public company?
No effect at all. We got a lot of money. I still retained majority ownership, and therefore I had the ability to make decisions, and people who bought the stock have never bothered us very much. They just enjoyed the profits. As long as the company was making money, they were happy. So that's good.
Right.
Well, that's basically it. The whole analytical instrument business seems to me to have been tucked away in the bio instrument business. That there's a lot of stuff going on there where they use the methodologies and so forth. There isn't an awful lot. I don't even know what the market is for infrared spectrometers anymore. How many chemical companies buy them? I suppose they still buy them. And the new Perkin-Elmer, which was formerly EG&G, probably continues to sell stuff. A lot of the FTIR companies that started to show up have been fading from the scene. The original Perkin-Elmer group still is doing quite well, I think. But I don't know what's going to happen, but it looks like it's getting folded in with a lot of other stuff. It's no longer a business unto itself with ideas of its own. The gas chromatography thing came along, and the UV spectroscopy, and infrared spectroscopy, and liquid chromatography. These techniques have all been plugged into other total systems. I think the successor company to Perkin-Elmer, which is the what's it called? The
Applied
Biosystems. They do that. They take known methods and they put together systems that are valuable for the biological field.
Hmm.
So we'll see what happens on that. Paul Wilkes has done a wonderful job of finding niches over the years. I've always admired what he's done with his companies. He's done some remarkable things with infrared in particular, and he found some markets such as measuring carbon dioxide in coke and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So he's been very successful. He's made a lot of money for himself, I think.
Hmm. How How has the pace of change in the semiconductor industry affected your pace of product development in the metrology sector?
We have increased our pace.
Mm-hmm.
The semiconductor industry has continued to evolve into products which are more and more complicated and have smaller little areas to measure, and therefore the ability to make those measurements has become paramount to those companies. They used to like to buy film thickness measuring systems. Now they have to buy these new systems in order to make the products at all. So that's where we have continued to prosper, by introducing a variety of very interesting and very high technology products which they are interested in.
Hmm.
And that's what we've been pushing forward.
Yes, we were just reflecting a little bit about, you know, the future fate of the analytical instrument industry. But what we haven't talked about very much is your life outside of work during your life in California, about your outside interests and activities. Could you tell us a little bit about that, if you don't mind?
Okay. Yeah. I don't mind.
Who's the person? Yeah.
For the last 4 or 5 years, I have become very interested in the way the human brain works. And I have provided some philanthropic investments to researchers who are doing important work in that field. People who are figuring out what is Alzheimer's all about, Parkinson's disease, things of that nature, what's going on inside your brain. It's a chemical thing, and it's mostly chemical. And how does that happen?
Hmm.
I've always been curious about that. Now I've put that to use, because I've now made some pretty big investments in laboratories at Stanford and at Berkeley, University of California, San Francisco. I have set up a mass spectrometer lab at Stanford. I've set up a very advanced mass spectrometer lab at University of California, San Francisco. Also Salk Institute and UCLA. And people who are doing this work, I try to seek them out. And I usually like to find guys who are in their late 20s or early 30s, because I believe where the big stuff comes from. And then I provide them with funds which allow them to do research or buy equipment or do whatever. There's a guy at Yale University, his name is Steve Strittmatter, who is trying to find out why, when you land on your head and you bust a nerve in your neck, you become a paraplegic. And it turns out that when you bust a nerve in your central nervous system, it will not heal, it will not grow back.
Hmm.
And why is that? So he's found out a lot about that, and he's on the verge of announcing a vaccine which can be injected into people and they've hurt their neck, that will cause those nerves to grow back. That's like a $1 billion idea, right? Or a $10 billion idea. So I consider that to be good stuff to work on.
That's quite exciting.
The guy at Harvard, I've made him a full professor. His name is Dennis Selko, who has developed a vaccine for Alzheimer's. And I financed a lot of the work he did on that over the last few years.
Hmm.
And that's being tested. And
where did that...
You're baby boomers, right?
I am, for sure.
I think I just missed the cutoff by a hair.
Yeah, but as you get older and as you get into your 60s and 70s, Alzheimer's is going to become a major thing. And it's going to become about 5 times more serious a problem for the world as it is right now, although it's very serious right now. In around the year 2010 and thereafter, there will not be enough people to take care of the people who have Alzheimer's. There will not be enough medical people who can take care of these people. Because the baby boomers, there's going to be so many more. So unless there's some kind of a vaccine that keeps that from happening, this is going to be a major economic catastrophe for the world, just as AIDS is, and now this SARS thing has come along, and malaria is another one.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in that stuff, and I'm interested in using my methodologies for seeking out the right people and then providing them with the funds so that they can do the stuff, hopefully, that works, that will develop a result in those things. So I'm very interested because I get involved in mass spectrometry and then optical microscopy and electron microscopy and all kinds of stuff. And that's what I do.
Is it that, do these researchers have a great demand for equipment, for measuring instruments?
Yeah, they usually have demand for fancy optical microscopes. And some of the people want to measure proteins and determine them, so mass spectrometer gets involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys that won the Nobel Prize have to do with the ability to measure these higher molecular weight materials. And so yes, there is, but more particularly is what they're doing and what they have to do.
Mm.
Agnes?
Yeah.
Do I have on my desk that, or someplace, that report that came in from Joe DiCicci, the one that did the SARS thing, S-A-R-S thing?
Yeah, I think it's in the file.
There's a picture of what he's done there. I went down and visited him last week.
Hmm.
He's 30 years old and he's come up with this blockbuster. They call him the rock star of biology. So that's good stuff, and those are the things that I'm working on. That beside, you know, continuing to participate in nanometric, is if I can take some of this ill-gotten gains and put them into stuff that is useful for humanity, that's what I'd like to do.
Well, it's an interesting approach to philanthropy as well, because you're not making a gift to some organization or something. You're finding out.
I'm not interested in bricks and mortar. I'm interested in people that I determine are on the edge of or can make some major thing happen.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they need some funds. There are young kids or undergrads who have good ideas that they just ain't, all they need is $5,000 so they can go to a meeting and give a paper.
Yeah. Mm.
So that's a big part of it. Yeah, there's a lot going on in bricks and mortar. You know, there's a lot of philanthropies around the Bay Area here that people are building whole buildings and donating money to do that, which is important. But they don't know what's going on inside those buildings. They have no idea. Mm. I'm interested in the guy in the lab that's looking through the microscope and seeing something. Is it on my desk there someplace, Agnes?
Yeah,
oh, you got it?
It's DeRisi.
DeRisi, yeah.
DeRisi, UCLA.
Yeah.
Well, one of the,
See that little microscope slide there?
It's amazing.
He took 12,000 viruses and got their DNA, separate viruses, and put them down on a little array, not the array on that slide.
Right.
And therefore, when the time came to find out what kind of virus the SARS was, he was able to identify it. So that's pretty important.
And you know, yeah, this analysis on a chip, you know, or this high throughput sort of analysis is just amazing. The virus chip. Yeah, and there's a great connection between, you know, they use a lot of these lithographic techniques, you know, like to make an integrated circuit.
Exactly. That's what he
did.
Yeah,
it's really fascinating stuff. Well, is there, are there any questions that I should have asked you that I haven't asked you yet?
Let's see, are there any areas, Well, since I knew you guys were coming, I knew I was going to have to